First thing I'd like to do is point out my two other co-authors, Peter Adler and David Beard at Clemson, and they're really the driving force behind a lot of this. Okay, first question, what do we mean by symbiosis? I follow the definition provided by people such as Sapp or Hooker, and that includes mutualism, dimensionalism, and parasitism. The reason I like this definition is we have a lot of interactions going on. In other words, commensalism and parasitism are just ends to continue, with a lot of rich interactions going on in between. And these interactions can be the result of environment, post-life stage, species diet interactions, and probably a lot of other things that we haven't even thought about. Now, as far as the macroecology and aquatic symbiosis, what do we know? Very little. What we do know is typical run-of-the-mill stuff. We know the insects that are involved and the symbionts. We know symbionts and toxins that are involved in their host record. We have distributional data. We have life cycles. We have a list of the common symbionts that we find, for example, the bacteria, protozoans, fungi, nematodes, and mites. But really nothing on a large landscape point of view. What we do have, though, occasionally is some interesting sort of commensalistic interaction. I had a student who was working on water scorpions, which are supposedly freshwater insects, but often served as commensals for things like barnacles and saltwater mussels. Now, one group that we do have a lot of information on are the flatflies. And the flatflies are a good group to look at, symbionts and aquatic habitats, for a couple of reasons. First of all, both the symbionts and the hosts are biosteric. So what does this mean? This represents a prevailing symbiotic relationship going on. Another thing is when they are colonized by the symbiont, in other words, when the flatfly pick up anything from a commensal to a parasite, we can actually determine this fairly easily. Also, flatflies are taxonomically well known. So if you get down to the species level, when we're dealing with the host, which is the problem for a lot of aquatic insects. Now, as far as the life cycle, this is very straightforward. Egg, larvae, and pupae of the flatfly are only in one habitat, that's not in water. So you can find them in little trickles to very large streams. So you can look at the whole variety of aquatic habitats. Now, the adults, of course, are terrestrial, and the females often take blood samples. Now, we're going to look at two broad groups of symbionts in this pod. The first group are the trichomycetes. So I'll give you a little bit more detail on those. And then these are the relationships we know they have with their hosts. They can switch back and forth between a commensal mutualistic relationship and also between a commensalistic to a parasitic relationship. And my gut feeling is the whole triangle will be complete once we spend some more time looking at them. The next group are limpets, microsporidians, which are probably highly derived fungi, and also a specific chytrid fungi, Leomycetium cerulei. These are all parasitic, as far as you know. Now, as far as the trichomycetes, I want to talk a little bit about these. These are actually a really neat group of fungi. They are cosmopolitan, and they are filamentous. Here you can see a couple of examples. And they're very easy to identify. They are obligate symbionts, and they are found only in the gut of arthropods, primarily aquatic insects, a few crustaceans. About 300 species we know of worldwide, and that number is increasing very rapidly. About 35 flatflies, and the flatflies are found only in the mid-gut and the hindgut. So, for example, if you were to look at a hindgut here of a flatfly, pull it out, this is what it looks like. And if you clear it, this is what the hindgut looks like. When there is no trichomycetes, this is what the hindgut looks like. When you pull it, it looks like. What I don't understand is when you have a gut full of trichomycetes like this, how does the flatfly material. I have no idea how it manages to do that. But it doesn't seem to bother the black box at all. Now, I want to talk a little bit about life cycle. It's really interesting life cycle. You see all three major groups of symbiotic relationships. Let's start off with the larvae. The hosts, larval hosts are filter feeders. They have these big fans out, and they're filtering in the water. triploscores, which is the asexual reproductive propagule of the trichomycins. And here you can see the fan ray, and here you have the triploscore being picked up. Then what happens is once they get into the host, either the midgut or the hindgut, and that's family-specific for the trichomycins, they will produce a whole fan, they will start germinating. Production of the whole fan and germination takes about 3 or 4 seconds, very rapid. Next, within about 24 hours, the hyphae start producing triploscores, which I mentioned is the asexual reproductive cycle. And then what will happen is these triploscores will be fall off the hyphae and then pass out of the gut. There is also a sexual stage. Oh, actually, before I do that, one thing I'd like to point out is that what happens in this stage of life cycle is that if you have healthy larvae, the trichomycetes don't seem to have any impact on the host whatsoever. And you can measure this a variety of ways. This is some data here showing you how we look at head capsule size, which is we measure honeybees in the last. And you can notice here those with trichomycetes and those without just one difference in size. And here we have two different initial doses of size for this experiment. And you can also do survival, you can also do development, you can do any other measure of fitness you might want. Doesn't change when you have normal healthy population. However, if you have a population in stress, you take your black light, for example, and you starve them for a few days, those with trichomycetes survive much longer than those without trichomycetes. The actual mechanism is something that works on right now, we don't really know. And just to finish off this life cycle, what we have is also a sexual producing stage. These are the zygospores. And this is the next thing where it gets interesting. For some reason, which we don't understand, occasionally these fungi, when they're in their larvae, will move to the pupal stage and then to the adult female stage. And once they're in the female, they will move into the ovarian tissue and replace the eggs with cysts. And then the cysts are laid, and then the cycle is repeated. Now, one of the things I was interested in, okay, this is a life cycle in one small area. Can you start looking at distribution of these things over larger scales? In other words, can we look at trichomycetes across habitats? And the thing I was really interested in, first of all, was looking at prevalence. Now, one of the things we looked at is we had 64 streams in Upper South Carolina. And these streams, from these streams we looked at about 2,000 hosts. The particular species we were looking at was the midgut trichomycetes, elemental cyanate, and here we were looking at prevalence. Now, when you look at South Carolina, we have three distinct ecoregions. The streams go from the basalt and rocky streams down to the slow-moving meandering sandhill streams. And the first thing we noticed is we just took a broad overview and just looked at prevalence. Okay, prevalence changes across these streams and habitats. Then we also took a couple of species. We took Sibelium tuberosum and Sibelium americana. And what we wanted to know was, can we predict prevalence using a variety of three parameters? And what we did here was took all these three parameters and then jumbled up them using a principal component analysis. You don't really need to know what the principal components were, except that they were habitat parameters. And as you can see here, in both cases, we had a fair bit of accuracy in predicting predicting prevalence based on these three conditions. Now, what about the pathogens? We have three basic pathogens. We have the vermiphids, we have the microsporidians, and we have this chytrid fungi. There's a little close-up of an effective one. And one of the first things we wanted to do here was say, okay, we had some success with the trichomycetes. What about vermiphids? They are a pathogen. Can we also predict their occurrence across stream types using stream parameters? And here what we did is we used two different species here. And with these two different species, we used, again, a variety of stream parameters. We crunched numbers down using a principal component analysis. We also included seafood and population size. And the thing we were interested in here is not so much prevalence, but occurrence. Which streams supported the population, which streams didn't support the population. Then as you can see here, this is a logistic regression system using the persons and absence in this case. And got a fairly high degree of predictability. Concordance is just equivalent to the R squared value when you're doing logistic regression using maximum likelihood predictors. Sample size has a small impact, season has a small impact, and real variables which were good predictors of where you found these remittances was habitat conditions. Okay, we want to expand out a little bit. And what we have here is a data set which is in progress. And so far in our database, we've managed to put in collections from 929 sites over 16 locations. And we've looked at about maybe 65,000 markers so far. And here we were interested in a couple of them. First, we have a community population of about 170 persons. Next thing is, because we had data across large areas of North America, we were also interested not only in prevalence, but also occurrence. And here's what we mean by occurrence. Let's take our data set in Florida, for example. We have 30 streams, we sampled about 2,500 large. And of those 2,500 larvae, we found a set of larvae from three streams. So occurrence in this case is 10%. So we have two different things to look at. We can look at occurrence. Here, you can see our three major groups, remittance, microsporidium, omicidia fungi. And with the remittance and the microsporidium, they occur in about 30% of the streams we look at. The kindred fungi, a little bit more. What is interesting too is you also look at the prevalence in this case. It's clear that remittance is dominant in parasites. Now, when you map this out, here's where the problem comes. There's no real pattern. We thought at first we might find some sort of longitudinal pattern or latitudinal pattern, but we don't find it. You can see you can find high prevalence right close to low prevalence. Prevalence varies east, west, north, south, there's no real trend. We get the same thing when we look at occurrence as well. Again, you look at these 16 sites, we get no obvious pattern. We just take a few right down here in South Carolina. 75% of the streams had infected larvae. We go a little bit north to New Jersey, less than 10%. No obvious pattern. This can also be seen by just plotting data or not plotting the correlations of the plot out prevalence and longitude and latitude. If you plot out occurrence, longitude and latitude, you can see that there's no overall relationship. The only relationship you do find is that there is a fairly strong correlation between prevalence and occurrence. Which means if you get to a site and you find there's a lot of nematodes, there's a good chance that that whole area around is going to support a large number. You see the same type of thing with the microsporidium. I won't go into a lot of detail on that. One thing I'd like to point out is that we do have about 11 species of microsporidia that we can identify. Occasionally, about 20% of them, we can't identify. Again, when you look at them, same type of thing. Yeah, I'm not really related very much, but no obvious pattern. And the same for occurrence, if you throw it up and you stare at it. Back here, just kind of go, well, I can't see any obvious pattern. And again, if you just look at the highs and the lows, nothing that really strikes you. One thing you do find with occurrence and prevalence is that the relationship's not that strong, which indicates that microsporidia are much more spotty. In other words, if you go to an area and you find a lot of microsporidia in a stream, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to find a lot of microsporidia in all the other streams throughout. What we are planning to do, and this is in the future, is we're going to take a landscape view and include a lot of the data that we can get from things like ArcView and also from the public domain. When we finish the database, we estimate we'll have about 10,000 sites. So we'll be able to do some fine level of statistics, really start piecing things out, and that we'll have over half a million markers. It's all been done, it's just a matter of getting it in the computer. I didn't realize a lot of data that we actually take to do it. And once we get that, we can start looking at things like topography, elevation, you know, technology, ecosystems, microinfrastructure. Climate, seasonal taxonomies, you can kind of put it in the hopper and see what's going on. Now, when you look at nematodes and sporidia, this is something I did on the slide just to try to compare it. I was looking at the prevalence and I was looking at their occurrence and I put them together and I did a correlation. And what you can see here is that if you look at prevalence across sites and you look at microsporidia and you look at there's really no strong relationship. But the reason when you look at sites, what that tells you is sites in which you find remittance, there's a very high probability you're also going to find microsporidia as well. Now, this is what I want to get on. What we need to do in the future. I would love for someone to work on the remittance system. I know it isn't going to happen soon. But this is the problem. We can get the microsporidia down the species, we can get the host down the species, but the remittent taxonomy, at least in last time, so until we get that, we're kind of stuck, because the thing we can't separate out with the remittent is host versus habitat specificity. In other words, when you find nematodes at a site, is it because of the stream condition? Is it because of the host? Or more likely, is it an interaction? Can't tease that out until we get the systematics of the remittance work out. You can tease this out with the microsporidia, you can tease this out with the trichomycin, you can't do it with the remittance. Other thing is we have to start looking at mechanism. What's propagating these things? How are these things spread? For example, this is a very simple disease model, and in this model, L stands for infected, S stands for susceptible. And what this model is saying is that the change in infection over time is a result of how many susceptible individuals you have out there. C is the contact between individuals. P is the probability of contact between a susceptible and infected individual. And Z is the probability that it is diseased or that its mental will actually transmit. Now, you can actually start looking at this in a mechanistic point of view and put it within a setting of, let's say, a stream habitat. For example, we're building models now looking at the probability of contact between uninfected and infected hosts. And in the stream, there's a positional relationship. Say you have a black white sitting here, and it has been uncolonized by a symbiote. Here you have an infected one, right? What's going to happen when this releases any sort of symbiote, it's going to infect this down here. Now the question we ask for any sort of simulation is what are the odds or what's the probability or how does this positional relationship change having infected upstream susceptible? And if you make a few simple assumptions, and again we're just working on the models and assuming the patches, individuals you pass whether you find the black flies are independent, and that each black fly, whether it's infected or not, occupies the same amount of space. And then S and I individuals are randomly distributed. Here's what you find. You find that the probability of becoming infected goes up with population size, which is in population size, which is not a surprise. But what is interesting is any simulation you do, it comes out as a curvilinear relationship. And most of the standard models assume that this is a linear relationship or remains constant. And finally, one of the things we'd like to look at phylogenetic forms. And give you an example, say we have six flies and we do a simple phylogenetic analysis on them and we find they form two different groups. Now what we want to do is superimpose symbiotes. Here we have six symbiotes. Question is, do the black flies and the blue flies tend to infect one particular group of symbiotes? Do the black flies and the brown tend to infect another? In other words, is there a phylogenetic signal buried deep in the host symbiotic relationship? Okay. And with that, I'd like to thank all these people that have helped me and also my funding sources, and I'd be glad to take any questions you might have. Thank you.
How do they get their nourishment in the long haul from the microbiome?
don't even know the relationship between them.
Yes.
The mechanism of killing, any speculation with the mechanism of killing?
In terms of relationship with what?
Yeah, with the mechanism of
killing. It could be as simple as the trichomyces are acting as scaffolding, so that you get a lot of bacteria growing on them, and then the black line absorbing the bacteria. It could be something like a seagrass analogy, or some of the coral analogies as scaffolding are pretty important, and some of the different types of areas where the plants in fact connect. So if you take that out, it could also be enzymes, vitamins, we don't know. One thing you do know is that when you start the black line, you look at the trichomyces, what happens is they think it's over that difference. And that's probably a cue that they realize the species aren't good as time to get out. They're probably detected with something going on.
Thank you.